Stefan Larsson is now going to tell us how to do the statistics correctly, right?
I'll try. Thank you, Dave. So this will be another talk on multi-wavelength analysis, but this will be more methods than data. the aim of statistical analysis of multi-wavelength data is depending on from which direction you look at it. From the data direction, we want to characterize the variability and the multi-wavelength correlations. If you look at it from a theoretical point of view, from a model point of view, you might like to use the data analysis to test predictions from your models. And this effect, of course, depending on which way you start, it affects a little bit what kind of methods you're using and how you're analyzing, looking at the data. We also want to look to search for new phenomena, and we need general methods. The tools we use, of course, are light curves and the statistical tools. And there's a lot of complications, and I will go through some of those. Signal noise in the data, time sampling and resolution, the length of observations. We now have 3 years of Fermi data, so it's getting much better than it was for 1 year, for example. And also variability with time. Time allocations committees might not give us what we need, and so on. Would I need it?
No.
Good. So the data we have, in Fermi we have regular sample data. It has a high duty cycle. 20% of the time it's looking at any particular point of the sky. So it's very good for monitoring lots of objects on the sky, as you know. The signal to noise of Fermi observations is, I would say, low or moderate in most cases, even if there are during outbursts, much better than that. For radio, it's less regular, I say semi-regular at best, but there's usually a lot of gaps and irregular sampling. But often usually with higher signal to noise. There's a lot of tools that there is one choice we can do, whether we work with events or binned data, and the data affects also the data analysis quite a lot. And in last year's meeting, Jeff Scargill talked about this approach where we're using events data, and there's a lot of reason for doing that, but there's also reason for using binned data. But I will not dwell into that today. There's a lot of tools we used, and I've listed the standard things that you're aware of, I'm sure. I will focus a bit on correlations. And you've also already seen lots of cross-correlation functions. You will see a bit more. But I will focus a bit deeper into practical aspects, and partly because I think that the talk and the paper that Jeff Scargill gave last year is a very good introduction and overview over these methods. So if you want more of an overview, you should take a look at Jeff's paper and talk. So looking at cross-correlation functions, then there's a number of different ways of doing cross-correlation functions, and many of you have done these over the years, but not everyone has. These are the main different methods that one may use. And the Edelson Prolik discrete cross-correlation function is the most common one, but there's a few others as well. The interpolated cross-correlation function, where you interpolate in the light curves, while in the discrete cross-correlation function, you interpolate in the cross-correlation function instead. And there is the set transform, which also is used. Using a power density spectrum, first creating a power density spectrum and taking a Fourier transform of that is also a way to of course, to make a cross-correlation function, but that is not very common to use. So what do we want out of a cross-correlation function? In most cases, we want to measure the correlation, how strong it is and how significant it is, the first thing. And the second thing, if there is a lag between the two light curves, what is that lag and what is the uncertainty in that lag? The cross-correlation function doesn't tell us everything. It's the average information, and so it's not the full answer. So, but it's if you have a two light curves that contain similar variability with the time delay, maybe smooth, then that cross-correlation function is good at figuring that out. If there are variations which is sometimes similar and sometimes different, that will not be picked up by the cross-correlation function. So it will not be good for everything, of course. So the discrete cross-correlation function from Edelson and Pollock paper, that the is the classical cross-correlation function. You multiply the values from one light curve with the other one with some time delay and normalize with the variances. The idea with Edelson-Pollock was that instead you only use the data points that you have in the light curves. You don't interpolate like you do in the interpolation cross-correlation function. You only use the data points you have. It means that the time separations are not equal distance, but that they vary in separation. But you still, for each pair in the two light curves, you multiply them together to compute this unbinned cross-correlation function, discrete, unbinned discrete cross-correlation function. So it means that for every pair, you get one value here. So it's a matrix, I by J. You may also, divide with variance, and if you want, you can correct for the measurement errors. You may not want to do that. So, to get the discrete cross-correlation function, you then bin the unbinned one, and the way that you then get is an example shown here. These are two light curves, and these are, one of them is from the F gamma, so it's a 2 centimeter radio light curve. It's one here, the dashed one. Well, I think one is from the APEX monitoring. We have a poster down there which shows light curves from this project. This is PKS 1510. You can see that, yeah, this sampling is not very good because it's it doesn't pick out the details in the flaring, but we've seen these light curves from Marshall, for example, showed these light curves from the flaring event in the source. If I compute the unbinned discrete cross-correlation function, this is it. So this is the value, one value for each of those pairs. When I then bin it, I get this one here. So you can see that, yeah, there is a peak here with a lag of maybe 50, 100 days or so between the sub-millimeter light curve and the 2 centimeter light curve. Whether that is significant or not, that is another business, because the sampling here is not that good. The uncertainties that affect the cross-correlation function is basically three things. It's first the measurement errors. Second, it is the time sampling, and the third, stochastic variability. And in the previous talk, Walter explained how they used simulations of light curves to take these stochastic variations into account, and also the other ones, of course. We have used a different approach, in the talk by Lars Fuhrmann, you saw some of those results. Now we'll explain how we did that in just a while. the effects of stochastic variability, that is that the light curve, of course, will be, look different at different times, even if the variability on longer term has a particular power density spectrum. In the short light curve, you can see that as a realization of a stochastic process, and that would change with time. And that would cause artificial correlations. And part of this, you can see if you have two light curves with one player in each of them, you can get a chance correlation. You will get the correlation. If you have two players, one in each of the light curves, you will get the correlation with the lag, which is the separation between the two players. And those two light curves can have the same power spectrum, but they still will give a chance correlation where the I'll leave it like that. You see the point. So different ways of analyzing this cross-correlation function and the significance is this is approach which is similar to used by many authors and similar to what Walter presented, that you simulate light curves, you sample them, you add errors, compute the cross-correlation function, determine lag, do this lots of times, and then compute the lag distribution. So that is one way of estimating uncertainties. There was one alternative way which we have been using is based on from Peterson, 1998, where the two first error components are addressed. That is the measurement error and the sampling. And this is investigated first by adding additional errors and see what the effect of that is. You add errors corresponding to the measurements error and see how much that changed the lag. And you do this many times in Monte Carlo, and then you get a distribution. The second point is to imitate loss of information from data gaps and uneven sampling, and that is a bootstrap-like method where you have your number of points and you resample them in a bootstrap method. That is, you select data points but allow to select one point many times. So each time you select it, you can reselect the same times points again. And you do this also many times. So this is what it will look if you make an simulation. If I create the sinusoid, put in some noise, calculate the cross-correlation function, of course I get a good correlation here between the two sinusoids. If I increase the noise level, it will go down because of the noise. So it means that the low correlation there depends on the noise in the measurements noise. And so if I want to correct for that, I use this definition and a Kralik like that. It's a Kralik correcting the correlation coefficients, correlations with the measurement noise, the variance of the measurement noise. So this is what it looks like if I now run Monte Carlos, create many pairs of light curves, calculate the cross-correlation function, determine the lag by fitting a function here, determine the peak of the correlation function, and then plot the distribution of that. So the dispersion here tells me the uncertainty, and it's an estimate of the uncertainty in the lag determination. And one can check. What?
Put some light in this.
I put in.
You had some light in the original light curve.
I had a light curve with I put in some noise.
Yes.
To create the synthetic
light. Light now. We have two light curves.
Yeah, two, yeah. Two light bulbs, yeah. And
how
independent
much light?
Measurement noise and independent. Same signal, but different noise. Independent noise.
And then to... Okay? But, sorry.
You did not put any light, and eventually you have something to see some simulation to have a light.
Oh, what do you mean by light? There is a signal, the sinusoid. No?
Delay.
Oh, yeah, delay.
Delay.
Lag, okay, lag and lag. I thought it's a light. I couldn't make light. Oh, lag. Oh, of course, lag. I'll give you lag. Okay. Yeah, right. Good.
How much was it?
There was no lag at all.
Oh,
zero.
No.
That is also a lag. It's just zero. You know?
This is fine.
Oh, yeah. Okay. Well, now I see your point.
Yeah.
Because first I create two light curves with noise. And because there is noise, there is a lag. Then, in addition to do the estimate how large the error is, I put in just as one more time noise. And that produces a distribution around the one lag that was produced by the initial noise, which was to simulate measurements. Okay, now, sorry. So this is to illustrate the effect. And this is to show that this is, in that sort of case, it is a linear process, that if I put in the real simulated sort of lag, in the light curve, and then I add just as much again and calculate how much does it change from the first simulation. It should be just as much. So if I put in an RMS of 0.4 and add just as much noise, the effect on the lag determination is twice. It is 0.4 again. So that in this case it's very linear. The red is a line where it should be. These are the simulations I made to verify that it really does that. And when I do this sort of analysis, I always want to investigate and see how things work with simulation. That's a good way to do that. Next question is, how do you determine the lag? And there have been different ways of doing this over the years. Whether you use the peak, whether you use some centroid or central gravity of this, it has been shown or said by many that you shouldn't use the base because that is more uncertain. It's better to use near the top. But what I do is I fit a Gaussian near the top. Which I think introduces less bias. So this second part is then to investigate the sample, the uneven sampling. And I do this with a simulation here. This is a light curve without any noise. And I simply select, reduce the number of points here, and then make a random selection to 100 points, and then I do the bootstrap selection, which means that among these 100 points, I randomly select 100 again, but I allow to select one more than any point more than once. So it creates different cases. So I can do this many times, and then for each of those, I calculate the cross-correlation function and look at the distribution of that. That is a recipe from Peterson, and I've tried this, and it works reasonably well. If I said that this case where I showed it was a linear relation when I added noise, if you're getting close to the detection limit, of course, when you make many simulations, you may lose the signal, the peak in the cross-correlation function and all that. You're not very So if you make many simulations, you will lose those. And in order to avoid that, what one can do is to do it step by step. So you take first the add noise to the first light curve, do the analysis. And you do the same for the second one, and then you do the bootstrap instead of doing everything at the same time. And then you add the variables. And that also works. Okay. So let's now come to the third part, which is the third point on that list, which is the stochastic variability, which is in the correlation between radio and Fermi is the biggest thing and the most uncertain thing. So in order to handle this, we're using a different way to do that than to simulate. We're mixing light curves as Loss said and showed. So we're taking, we have two sets of light curves. We have the Fermi light curves and we have the radio light curves. And it's about 50 or so of each, which means it's a fair number of light curves. And so we can calculate, in order to check the correlation, random correlation, we take different objects and correlate the light curve from this object and this other object. And of course, I didn't know about this other one. So under the assumption that the variability properties are similar, but we don't need to know what the character of variability is. We don't need to know the power spectrum and these things. We assume that it is similar. Of course, we can select a sample of sources which we are similar. We believe that flat spectrum radio frequencies are different from the electric in this. But we have a sample of sources and we do this mixed correlation. And because the gamma light curves are evenly sampled, they are very similar in that sense, while the radio light curves have different sampling. So we choose to correlate each radio light curve with all the other gamma light curves. The disadvantage here is that we have a limited number of light curves. We have only this 50 or 80 or something we're playing with. We don't have a million which you can deal with your simulator. So we do it like this. We have two light curves, one gamma and one radio. We cross correlate them and we get a cross correlation function which should include these random correlations of variability which is uncorrelated. And we do this for all light curves we have. It says loop over the pi's, which is radio, which is one, which loop over all the gammas. I already said that. So then the next step, which also last showed, that when we do this for individual sources, the significance of the correlation is marginal. That also you saw from Walter's talk that there is some sources where there is a detection, but for most of them it is not. And it is marginal. And therefore, by averaging them or stacking them together, we do get a significant correlation. See, you saw that in those plots that the cross correlation function for the sample of plastic and radio quasars and VLX by themselves have a very, very clear correlation. And we showed plots of these curves corresponding to these ones, which gave 99% or 90% limits on from these mixed correlations. So for the whole sample, there is a good correlation. So another question, which I think you already, I like what Alan Marshall showed about and talked about when there were these correlations. You showed the light curves of the TKS Hilton 10, for example, that in some cases there is correlation, sometimes there is not. And it's very, very clear when we look at these light curves that it's not a consistent pattern. It varies with time. So one way of attacking such things is to divide the data in segments, in time segments, and analyze them separately. One can compute power spectra, correlation function, cross correlation function for each segment, and look at variations with time. And this, of course, one can do both if one wants to see if there is a persistent property. I mean, if it is the same all the time, you should see it also in each segment. So that is a way to estimate the significance if something is stable. But it's also a way to see if something changes with time. If it does change with time, it could be either because there is a real physical change in the source, but it could also be an effect of stochastic variation. Stochastic variation can show up as these changes. That one can check that for each of these segments, calculate the output variation and power density spectra. So this is another example, again, for 5010. So this is a paper, multivalent paper here, which was coordinated by Andrea Tamateo. And this included a study of these three strong flares. It was the same outburst that you saw previously. And this is an example of a cross-correlation function where there is some consistent pattern. Whether it's real or not, I'm not saying, and we don't say that in the paper either. But what you do see is that in different, for all these three outputs, the cross-correlation functions have a lag of, what is it, about 2 weeks, about 13 days lag between R and gamma. So R was lagging the gamma by 13 days in those three cases. In addition, there is a small spike at lag zero. So there is two correlation components, one at lag zero, but the dominant one is peaking at about 13 days. So because this is divided three cases, and each of them see the same thing, that adds a little bit confident that it might be real, but still three cases is just three cases. So this sort of things is one need to look at more cases. If we look also at the light curves, and these are light curves here, which the mean is optical or that mean here. You can see that this is a case where there is an agreement with the variability between gamma and optical, and here is a strong flare. So one thing I want to say is that in just like Marshall Orthos has pointed out, that in the small details, there is sometimes a good correlation, and sometimes there is not at all. There's also one other thing, and that is that during this about 3-4 weeks long flares or outbursts, there is an increase in optical, while the gamma increases in the beginning, and then sort of the envelope, you say, is peaking earlier, while the optical is increasing more gradually towards the end, quite towards the end. And that is actually the reason why there is a peak at 13 days. It is that the optical is brighter at the end. There is an asymmetry in this outburst, that the optical is brighter at the end. And the gamma is brighter in the beginning. And because it's just three cases, this could be just a chance coincidence. Could also be a real effect, that it actually is a case that gamma is stronger in the beginning. So, another point with the cross-correlation functions, the trending. If you have a trend in your data, that will also affect your cross-correlations. And it is, so one should consider it, unless that trends or that long slow variability is really the signal you want to catch, to remove that. What I usually do is to make two cross-correlations, both dependent and not dependent. So one of the reasons for doing that is that you change the sensitivity. if you do a detrending, maybe with a polynomial, you will then measure the short-term variability. If you don't do that, you will include or might be dominated by the long-term variability. So that is a different information that you pick out. Depends on what you want to have, what you're looking for. This is an example of simulation where, again, I take this an apex light curve, and this is a 2 centimeter light curve again. These are the same I showed before. And this is when I add, this is the apex light curve as it is. Here I've added a trend, increasing strong trend, and I've indicated here in the cross-correlation function over here what happens with the cross-correlation function. But the dashed line here is the original one, the one I showed you before. It's peaking here. When I add this trend to the data, the cross-correlation function starts to go down here, move to larger legs because of this flux over here wants to be correlated with the peak here. Creates this distortion. As an illustration of this. So I think that one of the main, two of the most important challenges with doing cross-correlation analysis is to try to disentangle these effects that is not consistent with time. There is this mixed behavior that there is correlation and there is some features that are not correlated. So complexity in the sense that at the same time in the same source there is different behavior, and there is probably also non-stationarity in the sense that variability property changes with time. It's quite obvious when we look at place off that the variability properties are not constant. This is something, of course, that depends on the time scale. The longer time scale we observe, we might be able to resolve these things. And finally, I would like to end by showing this is the software that I'm using that I've developed for doing this analysis and timing analysis and correlation analysis. And this is available on the net. It's a bit old-fashioned menu-driven system, but it's good for making interactive playing with data and making a plot. There is a plot interface to IDL. So what I use is I play around with the analysis, and once I know how I want to do it, I can repeat many times by simply pasting it once into the command line. There is quite a lot of help by giving negative values of all the options. So there is a lot of timing analysis methods and cross-correlation. It's available both for Mac and for Linux, only in binary because there is on the web because there is some numerical recipes routines in that. If you want to try it, this is great. Okay, that's what I wanted to say.
Comments? Questions?
All the things you can do on that.
Yeah.
It's like a lot. As soon as I need to do something, I put it in there. I've done that for 20 years, so that is that tough.
Other questions?
Conditional
regulation analysis.
Yeah.
Means that I know this output class, this output natural, they are matched with each other.
Yeah.
And after this, I would like to forget it.
Yeah. Then I think you should look at the light you're fitting.
Right?
Because you say that that test crop is there and believe that these are players.
Yes,
they agreed. Yeah. Then I would say that when you look at the West, then I would fit with the hundreds of the player. And that would be multiple
places.
Yeah, or so
we use something like that. Well, different people are doing this keeping in function with their profile.
And subtract,
or add additional ones and add them together all at the same time. Say regarding such correlations on the power density spectrum. Because I haven't talk about that, but I think that we're now at the stage where we can look at, if you look at the light curves, you see flaring, and sometimes you see very rapid flaring, like between 273 and rapid flare and the sequence of them. So, and they occur in clusters, usually, often.
Yes.
There are active periods when there is energy. So it indicates, I think, that it shows at least that they are not random, completely random. They're doing some period. And I think that each of these players have some similarity. They would also have some, I would say, almost similar. If it had been random, it would have been a power spectrum determined by each player, and then a break and a flattening towards low frequencies, quite at low frequencies, and then another break. Now, if they are correlated, if they occur during activity phases, there is some sort of correlation between them. It means that there will be power locally, so they will not be placed in a power spectrum and not be flattening towards low. This is what we see, I think. But we don't see a break. We don't see a flat. That is also a way to look at correlations. Maybe not look at
that. Okay. Let's thank our speakers.
Yeah.